BadQuaker.com podcast. Today is Monday, April 30th, 2012, and this is podcast number 137. My name is Ben Stone, and I have a couple things I wanted to touch on, including an email, and I'll get to that in just a second. You may, I should go ahead and just say this. I've teased it a little bit in the past. In the upcoming future, we're going to be making some changes to the website at badquaker.com. We're very excited about that. We're considering the possibility of adding a forum to the website and a couple other features. We've wanted for a long time to have a page where you could access all of the archives in one location rather than having to search for them. And it's kind of clunky the way it is right now. It's very awkward and cumbersome. So we've wanted for a long time to have a single page where you could get access to all the old downloads, or possibly even a single download with, or say two downloads with, you know, like 50 podcasts on one download and 50 podcasts on another download and so forth like that. Anyway, we're looking at all those types of things in the updating of our website. We've had, good conversations among the staff, badquaker.com staff, and we have, a company that is working with us, and we're kind of kicking proposals back and forth on how we're going to do it. So we're very excited about that. That's coming up in the future. I'm not sure when that'll take place. It may take a few weeks, but we're going to move on that as quickly as we can. I wanted to touch on something else too before we really get going in the podcast here. If you're a regular listener, or if you've been listening for a while, you will know that I have talked at times about my association with certain biker gangs back in the late 70s. And I was never actually in any kind of biker gangs or anything like that. But I knew people, and I would, you know, perform services for them as far as like collections, and I would go riding with different ones and things like that. It was a very large motorcycle culture in Southern California, and we all sort of accepted each other's oddities. But I never actually was a member of any of the biker gangs that I was friendly with. Now, that didn't mean I wasn't sympathetic toward them. I was. I assisted them in, you know, individual members of different biker gangs at different times. I would help them. I would do this or that for them, and they would do this or that for me. I would be, you know, we would trade off, sort of an underground economy of favors and so forth. And I'm bringing that up because I've had a couple questions. You know, I, on Facebook and at other times, I have mentioned the hacker group Anonymous. And I want to make it clear here on the podcast that I am not a member of the hacker group Anonymous. I have never been and never will be. I'm not, skilled in that area. Any skills that I might have had in that kind of computer, related stuff, I lost years ago through one or more concussions. So all that's faded away, and so I have no possible actual involvement with Anonymous. On the other hand, I'm very sympathetic toward Anonymous and what their goals are and what they're trying to accomplish. And so I kind of see my association with Anonymous the same way as with those biker gangs back in the 70s, so that on a legal basis, if there was any anything that came up, there would be absolutely no connection whatsoever between me or badquaker.com or any of the staff at badquaker.com with Anonymous. We, you know, we don't use our computers. We don't allow them to use our computers. There's no association whatsoever in that. And yet, in a very real sense, they are moving in the same direction that we encourage people to move. So, you know, that can be translated however it needs to be translated, but realize that there is no actual, you know, financial support or any electronic support or anything connecting the anonymous hackers with badquaker.com or myself or any individual at badquaker.com. Okay, so that's a legal disclaimer. So if any accusation comes up later, just refer back to this podcast because everything I just said is true, and I know that it's true because I said it, and I don't lie. Someone on my Facebook that I'm friends with on Facebook sent me a thing he titled An Interesting Proposal, and I thought it was really interesting. It goes like this, the interesting proposal. Instead of, oh, well, let me give a background. Currently, as I'm sure you know, currently for the United States of America to go to war, if it's a legal war done constitutionally in the way that, say, people like Ron Paul want things to be done properly, a legal constitutional war, the United States government would have to have Congress declare war. And that's according to the Constitution. Any war that the United States involves itself in, where there is no constitutional declaration of war, is an illegal war according to the Constitution. So that means literally every military action since World War II has been against the Constitution of the United States. And every president who engaged military action using nothing more than some type of congressional approval of some kind without a declaration of war, or by using just presidential powers, it can be argued that all of those are constitutionally illegal actions on the part of the president. And people like Ron Paul have stated that, and people like Andrew Napolitano has stated that. On the other hand, even if we accept that presidential actions or congressional approval of military actions without an act of war, even if we accept that as being legal, which again, it has no constitutional basis, but if we accept that it's legal in the United States, then we have two methods that the United States may engage in war. One, through a actual act of Congress declaring war, and two, being the whim of the president. Now, considering that this is the current process that we have, the person on Facebook that sent me this interesting proposal said, what if instead of a congressional declaration of war, or just, you know, the president's whim, what if it was required to have a public referendum where only those eligible to serve in combat could vote, and those who voted yes to go to war are immediately drafted into the military? And then there was some more added to it as well, but I just thought that was, I thought that was really fun to read when he sent me that, in Facebook. I want to read it again. He says, interesting proposal. Instead of a congressional war declaration, require a public referendum where only those eligible to serve in combat may vote, and those who vote yes are immediately drafted. And the first thing I thought of was the Iliad by Homer. In the Iliad, Homer tells the tale of the Battle of Troy, or the War of the Trojan War. Actually, not a single battle. There was a multitude of battles, but the Iliad is about the Trojan Wars. And as you read the Iliad, what should strike you is the comparison of war in those days to war now. There were no conscripts, at least not on the attacking, not on the aggressive side. On the defensive side, inside the walls of Troy, I'm sure the people defending their city were pressed into service as much as possible, you know, realizing that it was either defend the city or fall to the invading Greeks. But all of the Greeks, all of Agamemnon's forces that were outside of the walls attacking Troy were there voluntarily. They were there either by political association with Agamemnon, or because they believed in his cause, or in the case of someone like Achilles, it was for glory, and, you know, essentially he and his men were mercenaries in a very real sense. Now glory was an aspect of it, but wealth and riches were an aspect too. I'm thinking of in the story of the Iliad. There's a point where Agamemnon insults Achilles. And so Achilles just pulls back and says, fine, I'm not fighting. And his men had a voluntary level of dedication to him. And because of that, all of Achilles' men just pull back and don't fight. And because of that, Agamemnon faces a really serious defeat on the battlefield. Because, when you have a voluntary army, you can't just send men out to die en masse, without having repercussions to that. And that's a very important thing. Now, and people say today in America, well, we have an all-voluntary army. Well, I've made this argument before, and others, far more intelligent than me and with a far better, reach in their audience than I have. Not a better audience, I might say, but just a wider audience. Anyway, a lot of other people have made this point that in the United States, we really don't have a voluntary army. Now, there are a lot of people in the military who are there voluntarily. But a good portion of the people in the military are there because the economic reasons, the economic circumstances in the United States have created an atmosphere where they don't have a lot of choices. And so they are practically forced into the military purely for economic reasons. And I believe Kai and I were talking about that on a podcast not that long ago, that in some situations, it really is a matter of either go into the military or stay in the neighborhood that you're in with the crime level that you're in, and you're pretty much guaranteed to be in a gang, or, you know, arrested for drugs or whatever in the very near future, because there's just no other lifestyle available for some of those people. And that is a situation that is entirely created by the government's war on drugs and the prohibition of drugs. Without that, then these products would be available on the market like every other legitimate product, and you wouldn't have all the layers of gang activity and all of the crime that goes with a black market product like that, the same as we had during Prohibition back in the 20s and 30s. So, in a very real sense, the government has created a situation by utilizing its war on drugs and by the government, can we say intentionally destroying the economy? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know if they really are. There's an interview with Scott Horton over at antiwar.com where he interviews, I actually intend to use part of that interview probably on the next podcast. It's about a half an hour interview, and I'm not sure if I'm going to play the whole thing or just some pieces of it. It's an excellent interview. Consider this a teaser for that interview. But, in that interview, we get the impression that the people, pulling the financial strings in governments or in the United States government are just idiots. And that may be, there's an old saying, you don't blame on evil what can be attributed to incompetence. And so there is a lot of that in government. But whether by incompetence or intentionally done, the United States government has destroyed the economy of the United States. And in doing so, they have created an atmosphere where one of the only ways that a person can pull themselves out of poverty is to go into the military. So in a sense, that's a form of draft. It's not as really nasty as the lottery type draft that they had in the 1960s, where they just pull up a series of numbers and you just get sent a letter and off you go. It's not necessarily like that. But in ways, it's very much like the form of draft that existed in England back in the 1700s, where poverty was so bad that sometimes the only way that they could actually make a living was to join the Navy or, you know, one of the other options like that. The other option at the time to escape poverty was to sell yourself into servitude as an indentured servant. And so that's slavery. So, you know, that option is not as readily available in the United States today. We don't have indentured servants in that sense in the United States. But really, that's what the military is. You sell yourself into the military for a set number of years, and you cannot escape it under penalty of punishment. And you're given subpar wages during that time. And you're promised things like training and education and so forth, but they don't have to go through with that. There are a lot of people who have stories that'll tell you that they did everything they were supposed to do. They joined the military. They thought they were going to get an education. They thought they were going to get trained, and they got nothing. They got guard duty, and that's it. You know, and that's some basic training, and that's about it. And they're stuck off in some desert, and now they've got to live with it. So in a sense, in a very real way, when you've created an economic atmosphere that the U.S. government has created, you have a form of draft right now. So if there was a way to do these things in a fair and equitable way, then I think my friend's suggestion in Facebook would be the only fair and honorable way to have a decision about whether or not to go to war. Let those who will actually be fighting the war decide if they should be fighting the war. And this was the traditional position through history up until not that long ago. The Persians began pressing people into war back in ancient days. But the problem with the Persians pressing people into war, of course, almost all Persians under the Persian Empire were slaves anyway. It was very much like a lot of other empires in that sense. But the problem with the Persians with their pressed military was that when they would face a voluntary military, like we saw at Thermopylae, the voluntary military is far more effective than the pressed military. And then throughout Western culture, you don't see very many forced militaries until you get all the way up into some of the almost modern states of like Spain and France and England. Certainly Eastern Europe, the principalities and the military culture of the Prussians and of Eastern Europe was not one of forced military well up into the time of Bismarck when empire began to take over in Eastern Europe as it had in other places. And then again, dealing with the United States, although there was some forcing, some pressing of the military under Washington, mostly the War of Independence was fought by volunteers. And the ones that were pressed and the people that had to deal with Washington's lording behavior, They were pretty ineffective. Washington himself and Washington's troops, unfortunately, and you might get some debate on this, but I believe I can make a pretty good argument for what I'm about to say. Washington and his troops were pretty much ineffective. They didn't even qualify as a good irritant. You know, independent groups guerrilla fighters throughout the colonies were far more effective than Washington ever was at irritating and agitating and confronting the English. And in a pitched battle, you know, Washington typically resigned the battle, would pull away as quickly as possible because there was no way he could stand, his little ragtag group could stand up to the English in a pitched battle. There's just no way. So, you know, even in that situation. And then we didn't have a pressed military all the way up until the tyrant Lincoln came along. And, of course, Lincoln began pressing people into the military. And he ended up with a almost open rebellion in New York over that topic. Because for some reason, oddly enough, he tended to press the poor into service, and the richer ones could just purchase their way out of it. So, it's not like something like that could happen in the 60s, Dan Quayle, or, you know, like anything in the 60s where somebody, George Bush, could just use the pressures of their family and not go off to war while everybody else their age was going to war. Okay, well, that was a long, long topic to talk about over a simple note in Facebook. But on the other hand, it was a good note. It was a fun note. I think I'll read it again. Interesting proposal. Instead of a congressional war declaration, require a public referendum where only those eligible to serve in combat may vote, and those who vote yes are immediately drafted. I think that's just wonderful. I just love that. Okay, now I want to jump ahead a little bit here in my notes. Let me check the time and see how we're doing. Yeah, it's not quite time for a commercial yet, so we better just stick with it and continue on our notes here. Now, I mentioned that I had an email. I think I mentioned that I had an email that I wanted to go over. If I didn't mention it, hey, guess what? I've got an email that I want to mention. But before I do that, though, let me touch on something that I was talking about on a previous podcast. It might have been the last podcast. Actually, this is a good time to bring this up too. For a long time, almost the whole first year, whenever possible, Kai would do a podcast with me, and that would usually be one or two podcasts a week. And then I would try to get in, two or three more. So we would try to get in five podcasts every week. And usually we were able to do that. Sometimes we weren't. There was a lot of travel last year when my mother-in-law was ill. And, so with a lot of the travel, there would times when I could only get in one or two podcasts per week. And there were other events that took place, illness and other things like this that happened in the family. And, of course, the unexpected and tragic death of my son-in-law, John, that kind of threw everything off. But throughout all of that, we were trying to get in as many podcasts per week as possible. Our goal was to get five podcasts a week in, and we usually were able to come up with at least three or four, and sometimes it was only one or two. But and then we've been, all of us here have been just so busy going in so many different directions that we're cut down to sometimes one or two podcasts a week. And I really feel bad about that. I really want to give you guys more than just one or two podcasts. I'm going to really try, I'm saying this publicly here to kind of put the pressure on myself. I'm going to really try to not have less than three podcasts a week. That may not be all that easy. I would prefer to give you three good podcasts than five so-so podcasts. But I would like to actually go back to getting five podcasts a week. I don't know if we're going to be able to do that. Upgrading the site and upgrading some of our processes will help because we just took care of some business licensing issues. recently, and we're in the process of setting up like a Skype account and some other things like that that will allow a better quality of interviews. And so if we can get in like one interview a week, that'll help. In the past, I've been real hesitant to do interviews because my only way of doing that is to just set a microphone in front of a telephone that's, you know, on speaker, and the sound quality is really poor. So I've been kind of hesitant to really do a lot of interviews. But, with setting up the newer procedures, we might be able to have some quality interviews where the sound is not so bad. And I would be a whole lot more comfortable, doing that. And there's a lot of people out there who are, who've told me that they're willing to do interviews. So if we can get that set up, and maybe I could, you know, do an interview a week in addition to the three or four podcasts, that would take us a long distance towards having, you know, five a week. If you hear the noise in the background, we have a neighbor doing yard work, so I don't know if you can hear all that noise or not. But anyway, so that's my commitment. I'm gonna really try. I can't say anything is an absolute because who knows what the future may bring. But I'm gonna really try to get back to at least three podcasts a week, and it's my goal to get up to five. Most specifically, when we get the capability to improve our interviews, hopefully we'll have like at least one interview a week and then four podcasts, and that would be really nice. So, okay, now I think we've burned this on long enough that we can stick in our commercial here. And so I'll be right back with you in 2 minutes, and we'll get back to the topic. How would you like to support BadQuaker.com and get something nice for yourself at the same time? I want to tell you about Survival Gear Bags. It's run by my friend Kelly, who believes in and adheres to the non-aggression principle. Kelly's customers know him for his great customer service and his personal touch because Kelly handles all customer service himself. The main focus of Survival Gear Bags is to allow you to build your own custom emergency kits with quality gear. Now, I know this because I bought my bug out bag from Survival Gear Bags over 2 years ago, and I've gone all over the country with it by my side. And you can rest assured that the prices will always be the best they can be at Survival Gear Bags. And if you use the link from BadQuaker.com, they'll probably throw in something for free for you with your order. Now, how do you do this? Well, it's simple. You go to BadQuaker.com. On the right side of the page, click on the picture of the backpack. Then look around at Survival Gear Bags and find the stuff you want. You'll help BadQuaker.com, and you'll support a merchant that's one of us. Now, I want to tell you about another way you can support BadQuaker.com and get something really cool at the same time. Shire Silver. Shire Silver is the proud seller of silver and gold trade cards. Shire Silver believes that silver and gold trade cards will show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. So what are silver and gold trade cards? There are specific weights of gold and silver laminated inside credit card-sized tradable cards. They're a handy and affordable way to trade precious metals. These cards received nationwide recognition when they were widely used as barter at the New Hampshire Porcupine Festival. You want a beer and a hot dog? Hand them a Shire Silver 5 card and get a Shire Silver 1 spot back as change. So again, what do? Well, you go to BadQuaker.com. On the right side, just below the backpack, you'll see the Shire Silver trade cards. Click on those cards and then check out Shire Silver's site. Be sure and watch Ron's video that's right there on the main page. And then swap some of those ridiculous Federal Reserve notes for something of real value. Something you can keep, trade, or give as the coolest gift ever. But be sure and use the link from BadQuaker.com. Thanks, folks. Okay, and I'm back, and that commercial wasn't so bad, was it? Maybe I can update those in the near future. I've been talking about doing that for a while, but once we get the new advertiser who's going to help us with our website, once we get the new advertiser in, I'll have to update all that anyway, so that might be a good time to do that. Okay, anyway, so I wanted to mention this email that I got, and it was in reference to an older podcast that I did on Selene's Law and what I called the Ron Paul effect. And if I can remember to do it, I'll put a link in today's podcast for, so that you can get back to that, so that you'll know what podcast we're talking about here if you want to go back and listen to it. So the email mentioned that and talks about how I had talked about talking about Selene's Law, and in that podcast I had talked about honest politicians being worse than the dishonest politicians. And then I had made the statement about voting, that is very common among a lot of anarchists, that voting violates the non-aggression principle. And I think what I did in trying to explain the position, I may have muddled my explanation, because I introduced some discussion about politicians attempting to be reelected, and that really wasn't necessary for my point. And so I think it may have thrown off my point. It may have distracted from what I was trying to say. I could have made my point without mentioning their constant, striving to get reelected. I could have made my point without that. So I thought what I would do is, here's the other thing. Now, I got this email asking me about my comments on Selene's Law. And literally, as I was reading the email, my wife was on a different computer. We have, two computers in the same room, with her desk and my desk are back to back, and that's in a different room than the recording one that I'm in right now. But anyway, never mind all that. So I was reading the email, and my wife was reading on I'm not sure which news site, but she was reading about this scandal with the Secret Service, and she laughed and she says, "Ha. Listen to this. The Secret Service is going to have security assigned to the Secret Service to watch them and make sure they're doing okay." So what we have is, we have the watchers, the Secret Service watchers, and they have watchers assigned to them. So we have watchers for the watchers. And I almost couldn't contain the humor in that, because that's exactly what's one of the aspects of Selene's Law. So these two things together just told me, hey, you have to bring back up Selene's Law. You can't let this opportunity go by. So then, Selene's Law. This comes from Robert Anton Wilson's The Illuminati Papers, and Selene is the last name of one of the characters that is sort of like Wilson uses Selene as sort of a mouthpiece to say the things that he wants said in the novel. Sort of like if you're a Ayn Rand fan or follower or whatever, kind of like what she does in her novel with that long-winded speech in I hadn't planned on mentioning her or the book, so the whole thing just leapt out of my mind. But anyway, no matter. That's the purpose. Wilson uses Selene as a mouthpiece to express anarcho thoughts and principles. So in Selene's Law, I'll just read them through here real quick here. National security is the chief cause of national insecurity. To have national security, one must create a police force, or in this case, he says, a secret police. Since internal revolutionaries and external foes would make the police a prime target for infiltration, and because these secret police would by necessity have vast powers to blackmail and intimidate other members of the government, another higher set of secret police must be created to monitor the secret police. And an even higher set of secret police must then be created to monitor the higher order of secret police. And then you just keep repeating this and repeating this. In other words, once you accept the idea, once we start moving towards a totalitarian government, and we decide that we have to have watchers everywhere watching us to make sure that our fellow citizens all obey the lists and lists and lists of ridiculous laws that go with a totalitarian society. Once we decide that, and so we hire a police of any kind, and then there has to be a secret police to watch those police, because the watchers can't be trusted, because they're just humans, they're just people, they're just citizens like the rest of us. So the watchers can't be trusted. So the watchers have to have watchers. And then those watchers are just people like the rest of us, so they have to have watchers. And so the watchers have watchers. But those watchers can't be trusted either, so they have to have watchers. So now we have watchers watching the watchers that watch the watchers who watch us. And you know what? Those watchers can't be trusted either, because they're just like us. And so there must be watchers to watch the watchers that watch the watchers, watch the watchers that watch us. And that's Selene's first law. Number two, accurate communication is possible only in a non-punishing situation. Now, this is such a revealing truth that is on so many levels. The more thoroughly you grasp this second law, second of Selene's laws, the more thoroughly you grasp this, the wiser you realize that Robert Anton Wilson was, or is. I'm not sure if he's alive. I think he's alive. Anyway, accurate communication is possible only in a non-punishing situation. Okay, I'll just read the little thing here. Usually, it is in the interest of a worker to tell his boss what that boss wants to hear, not what is the truth. In any hierarchy, every level below the highest carries a subtle burden to see the world in the way their superiors expect it to be seen, and to provide feedback to their superiors that their superiors want to hear. Okay, so essentially we're talking about yes men. You see this in industry, especially in big corporations. Each level, as you move up through management, each level surrounds themselves with people who will simply tell them what they want to hear. And if you don't conform to that, if you're the rebel who has a tendency to say the things that the manager doesn't want to hear, you probably, on a rare occasion, a manager will appreciate that. But most of the time, you're going to get moved out, and the yes men will all move up with the manager. And so when you get layers and layers and layers of this in a corporation, the corporation becomes more and more incompetent. And the same thing happens in government. As government becomes layers and layers of just bureaucrats saying yes to their boss above, you lose the ability to provide honest feedback up to the decision makers. So the decision makers are incapable of coming up with good decisions, because all the information that's brought up to them on each level is contaminated with the idea of providing information that satisfies the next higher boss. And and this even echoes out into family relations, on how a child and a parent will interact with one another. When very young children, oftentimes they will do or say anything to please their parents. And so we often think about the honesty of little children, that, you know, the out of the mouths of babes and that kind of thing, where they just spout off the top of their head whatever is the pure honesty that they think of. But much of the time, a child will say whatever it believes that the adult wants to hear. So, for example, I see these things regularly where, you know, these different people they go out and they interview children in a school, and they say, you know, we're here with the Fight the Hunger for the Children, or whatever their little name of their organization is. And we're going to interview these school kids, and then they talk to the little kids and they're like, do you know anybody who's hungry and who doesn't have enough to eat? And the little kids are like, yeah. Do you ever go to bed hungry? Yeah, I do. Well, the kid's lying. I mean, I'm sorry, but the kid is just lying. The kid is saying exactly what the kid thinks the adults want to hear. You've already set up a situation where you've brought in cameras. You've brought in these people with this organization which is quite clearly based on the concept that kids are starving. And then you start asking these little kids questions about if they ever go to bed hungry. Well, of course they're going to answer exactly the way they think you want them to answer. Because it's this hierarchy, it is very obvious in the situation. You can't have honest, accurate communication when you have a hierarchy, involved like that. Kids will be honest among themselves sometimes, but not even always there. But they will not be honest when you bring a camera crew in with all the indication that you're there for a purpose. And then how many kids are actually going to go contrary to that purpose and tell you the exact opposite of what you want to hear on camera? So, you know, you see that in that kind of situation as well. And you can have the same kind of situation in a parent-child relationship, or in a teacher-child relationship, or in a teacher-to-principal relationship, or a corporate manager with, you know, lower or higher individuals in a corporate structure or in a governmental structure. So the president, let's just say, the president never really gets accurate information. It is impossible for a president to ever really get accurate information because it has to filter through so many levels of hierarchy before it gets to the president that by the time it gets there, it can't possibly be accurate information because you can't have accurate communication in a non-punishing situation. Oh, I'm sorry, I said that backwards. You can't have accurate communication when in anything other than a non-punishing situation. Okay, now the third law, and this is the one that confused the person in the email. The third law is an honest politician is a national calamity. I really think that first off, let me cover the meaning of Selene's law, and then I'll deal with the Ron Paul factor afterwards. Okay, so the meaning in Selene's law is that a dishonest politician, you spot them right away. You know what you know what their goal is. Their goal is to fill their pockets, and their goal is to get all their buddies cush jobs and put themselves into positions of power so that they can have influence and get all their buddies, you know, put into positions of power. And that's what they're doing. It's very obvious. So a dishonest politician is predictable in the sense that what they really want to do is line their pockets. Well, a person like that not only can be easily caught, but they're not hard to spot. If you think about what the public witnessed with that governor of Illinois not long ago, when this guy comes out, you know, all the accusations came out about him, and the recordings of his phone conversations came out. But it really, all you had to do was listen to the guy talk for a few minutes, even before all these accusations came out, and you could pretty much tell that this guy was really in the whole process to line his pockets. And so it's not hard to spot politicians like that, and it's not hard to predict the behavior of politicians like that. On the other hand, let's just take somebody like Barack Obama, the current president of the U.S. Now, here's a guy who I really think buys his own con. I think he really believes that he's there for the purpose of helping and not there just to rule an empire. You take somebody like the hated, Nancy Pelosi. This is a person that the right just loathes her. They just hate her with echoing vengeance. They hate her. But if you really listen to her when she's talking, listen to her speeches, listen to her when she's addressing the press, you realize this woman is deeply stupid. She's not evil. She's simply a moron. She is barely verbal. This woman, under any normal circumstances, would have a real hard time making a living at anything other than politics. I believe, she sincerely thinks that the stupid things she does in government are good. And without going into all the levels of how voters react and why voters vote in people like that, and there are reasons that voters vote people like that in, but without getting into all of that today, a person like Barack Obama or a person like Nancy Pelosi, or I'll even take it back even further, let's punch around the Republicans for a little while. I think George W. Bush was a moron. I don't think he was so evil. Now, you look at somebody like Dick Cheney, you look at somebody like, the other guy's name doesn't pop to mind, so I guess I'll drop him. But we'll just pick on Dick Cheney. You listen to a guy like Dick Cheney talk. Dick Cheney was not a moron. Dick Cheney was fairly smart and dangerous. Now, here's the guy that a lot of people in public, he only came to power specifically because he was working miracles inside the Republican Party, in the form of financial, deals and so forth like that. And then somebody like George W. Bush grabs onto him and, hey, why don't you be a part of my, and off he goes. Oh, sorry about that, folks. We had a very minor interruption, but I'll try to pick it back up again. So anyway, I think I was picking on Dick Cheney. Karl Rove is the other guy that I was trying to remember his name. You see people like Dick Cheney and Karl Rove, or you see somebody like, oh, see, now I did it again. I was going to pick on one of the guys from the Clinton administration who was clearly evil, but his name escapes. I can see his face. Anyway, there are people like this in politics that it's not hard to spot them and see how deeply evil that they are. But those people rarely obtain the kind of power that the idiots do. The people like George W. Bush and the people like Barack Obama. Those people are dangerous because they actually believe their own hype. They actually believe, an idiot like George W. Bush actually believes that we can go and bomb villages, and somehow those people over there in those poor, weak countries will not hate us for generations over this. Somebody like Barack Obama, who honestly says, oh no, we're going to stop this horrible torture in these terrible camps, and we're going to close these camps down, and we're going to cut back on the wars, and we're going to get, and then he goes in there and the advisors surround him and they start telling him things that he never imagined possible. And the next thing you know, they're just manipulating him however they want. And that's what the evil people in government do. The evil people get themselves into a position of where they can push the idiots and make the idiots do what they want. So when you look at somebody like Nancy Pelosi or George W. Bush or Barack Obama, you have to look past what they're saying, look past all the imagery that they provide for you, and realize you're looking at an idiot. You're looking at an honest person who really thinks they can do good, and they think they can use aggression and force and theft and do good with it. And that's a real problem, because a person like that is dangerous. You think for yourself, who would you rather meet? If you were walking down the street, would you rather meet a hardened biker criminal who had served several different times in federal penitentiaries, and he's just hanging out, sitting on his bike, relaxing in a dark alley? Would you rather meet him, or would you rather meet a religious fanatic who is convinced that they could torture you enough until they could save your soul for you if they tortured you enough? You see, the good-intending idiot is far more dangerous than the evil person who is actually, knowledgeable. Of course, like I said, in government, you get those people in positions, those evil people in positions of influence, and they can push the idiots to do all kinds of things. Okay, so that's kind of where that's an aspect of Selene's law and the third law of Selene's law. And now we introduce the Ron Paul factor. And I'll see if I can say it a little clearer this time and not fuzz up the discussion with campaign finance or some other thing like that. So, without going into, I said the Ron Paul factor, but I'm not actually going to go into the whole deal of the Ron Paul factor because Ron Paul doesn't fit either aspects of Selene's third law. He is not a moron and he is not evil. So he doesn't fit the normal mode for a politician because usually they fit one of those two categories. They're either evil or they're an idiot, and he's neither. So Ron Paul is the odd man out in that setting. However, my point that I made that caused the confusion was in saying that the anarchist, very often the anarchist position on voting is that voting in and of itself is an act of aggression. So let me see if I can explain that. Well, I'm kind of running out of time here. Let me check the time really quick. Yeah, I am running out of time. So I'll try to cover that as quickly as possible and see if I can do it a little bit better than I did last time. So so voting in and of itself is an act of aggression, according to many anarchists. Well, let's create a scenario here. Let's say we have in Fred Flintstone's world, and we're going down to the Water Buffalo meeting of the Loyal Order of Water Buffaloes. And so we go down to the lodge, and it's time for a vote to see who the new Grand Poobah is of the Loyal Order of Water Buffaloes. I'm having a trouble saying that, so I keep saying it over and over. Okay, so Fred Flintstone and and Barney. We'll say Barney Rubble. Fred Flintstone and Barney Rubble are running as the two people opposing each other for Grand Poobah of the Loyal Order of Water Buffaloes. In this scenario, everybody there is there voluntarily. No one is being forced. There is no taxation. There is no aggression being used. So everybody at the lodge is there because they want to be there. And so they vote, and they vote for Fred or they vote for Barney. And let's just say for the sake of discussion that Barney wins, and Fred's probably upset about that. Well, Fred is probably more upset than anybody else at the lodge over this. But Fred has a choice. Fred can continue his relationship with the lodge and voluntarily allow Barney to be the Grand Poobah, or he can leave, and there is no aggression. So therefore, at the lodge, the voting is in no way an act of aggression because everybody votes voluntarily, and the association is entirely voluntary. And if you don't like the results of the vote, you can withdraw from the association. So therefore, a vote in a voluntary association does not violate the zero aggression principle. Okay, but that's not the case in forced government. And all governments that we have in the world today that I'm aware of are forced governments. So, for instance, in the U.S., if we have a vote, if we have an election, you have the choice of voting or not voting. But every aspect of the election is paid for through taxation, through aggressive theft. And none of it, we don't have a choice about any of it. In other words, the government is going to have an election whether you want them to have an election or not. They're going to rob from you to pay for that election. So then once the election takes place, every act of a politician, every single act of the politician is an act of aggression because the politician is using, you know, whoever the politician is who got elected, whichever politician gets elected, every single act that they do as an elected official is an act of aggression because everything that they have done is through this forced association, We do not have the opportunity to withdraw from it. We are forced to support it both financially and through moral support by not rebelling against it at the, you know, at the threat of if we attempt to resist the government, they will step on us and crush us immediately. So for this reason, the governments that we have today are based entirely on aggression, threats of aggression, violence, theft, and layers and layers and layers of lies. So then, let's say we have a politician who's elected. Let's say that the politician, through his whole campaign, says, you know what, I just want to go in. I want to shrink government. I'm only going to go in for one term. I'm not going to try to seek re-election. I'm going to go in for one term. I'm going to do everything I can to shrink government, not pass a law, only revoke laws. So I'm not going to try to push anything new, any new aggressions on people. I'm only going to go in and try to revoke aggression that the government is already doing. Okay. But every expense that once that person is elected, every expense that they incur is paid for by stolen money. The fuel that drives them back and forth to, to Capitol Hill to do their job. Even if they decide not to take a salary, the lights that are on in their office are paid for by stolen money, aggression at the point of a gun, money taken from citizens against their will. Every piece of paper that's printed on every printer and every leaflet that's put out and everything that's written. And even if they decide that they're going to push to revoke laws, as they stand on the House floor, or even in local, it's the same thing echoing down to smaller bodies of government all the way down to city level or whatever. As they stand on the floor of whatever building that they use to legislate from, the floor that they stand on, the very floor that they're standing on, is paid for by stolen money that took the sweat of the brow of a victim to pay for the flooring and to pay for the roof that's over their head and the lights that illuminate the room. And every aspect of what they do and every piece of paper that prints what they said and every microphone that records what they say is all taken at the point of a gun. And when you vote for that individual to go and do those things, what you are doing is you are choosing to assign that person to make that theft on your behalf so that they can make government do what it is that you want government to do. Assuming in all of this that we're talking about an honest politician who's only going there for one term and only with the goal of shrinking government, that politician will utilize aggression in every single action that they take on behalf of the government. And when you vote for that individual, you are assigning that individual the authority from you. You are assigning them your authority to rob from other people to pay for the things that you want. Now, here's the other thing that an anarchist would say in regards to voting. When you have a majority of 51% and you have 49% in the minority, and let's say the 49%, they really, really want the government to haul them out of their bed randomly in the middle of the night and beat them. And they really want the government to just occasionally pull them over on the way to work and drag them out of their car and tase them two or three times. Now you're saying, well, that's psychotic. Why would people want that? It's not the point. If there was a case where 49% of the public wanted a government to do that, and 51% of the public said, no, we want the government to not exist in any kind of an aggressive manner and never violate the rights of individuals, then the vote of the 51% to force liberty upon the 49% would be an act of aggression. Forcing liberty upon people is the naive thing that many of those dumb politicians that I was tearing up a moment earlier, it's the very thing that they do. It's the very reason they justify all the evil things that they do. They think they're doing good and they're willing to bring aggression into play to accomplish the good that they want. And if we are willing to use aggression to bring liberty onto people, we've eliminated the possibility of us bringing liberty because we're bringing aggression. People can only live in a world of liberty by choice. And you might say, well, how can that be? You would need 100% of the people to embrace the thoughts of liberty. How could that possibly be? Well, guess what, folks? We've run out of time, so I'll have to answer that on another podcast. Folks, for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. Thank you very much for listening, and thank you for your emails and your support and for everything else, folks. And if you want to drop me a note, that's Ben, B-E-N, at badquaker.com. Thanks a lot, folks. Goodbye.